From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, helping teens in foster care buck the odds and get into college.
You know, I've seen a lot of youth that are college material, but they're just afraid to go on to college, and they don't have that extra family backing them.
The lessons other states can teach Michigan and how to improve our schools.
Enough is enough. We have a serious leadership problem in our state, and it starts from the top down.
How Minneapolis-St. Paul built regional cooperation on the foundation of a powerful metropolitan council.
It was set up that way basically to try to avoid parochial battles between local officials.
And Detroit, ready for Movement Music Festival.
It is one of the premier electronic music festivals in the world at this point.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There's good news being celebrated today in Lansing. It centers around the statewide initiative Fostering Success Michigan. Its mission is to help teens and young adults who've been in foster care graduate from college, succeed in building careers, and building independent lives. Staff and students from Fostering Success Michigan are at the Capitol today, thanking lawmakers for their support. You know, if you've grown up in foster care, you are bucking the trend if you get into college. A place that's helping young people do that is Thomas House in West Michigan. It's run by Samaritas. It's an independent living house for teen boys. And its manager, Danette Nordhoff, is with us now. Danette, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you here. And it's a pleasure to welcome Robert Flippo, who has been living at Thomas House. Robert, hello there.
Hi there.
So good to have you here. And we start by saying congratulations, because I understand you recently graduated from Union High School and you are headed to college in the fall. Where will you go and what will you be studying?
I'll be attending Kuiper College and majoring in youth ministry.
And why did you choose youth ministry for your major?
A lot of youth pastors and youth ministers have come through my life, and they made a lot of impact. And my plan was always to work with kids. And so I just thought that youth ministry would fit my need for paying it forward and then also like being able to work with the youth still.
When did you go into foster care, Robert? How old were you?
It was relatively recent. I came in of August in 2017.
Okay. And certainly all statistics show that you are indeed the exception to the rule. Only 20% of college-qualified foster youth attend college. What do you think were the hurdles that you encountered as you kind of made your way through dealing with foster care and also, I mean, as you say, not as long as some people have been, but still you've got challenges you've got to deal with.
Yeah, because you don't have your family with you, so that's also like a huge blow. So you lose like a lot of your support, and which makes it difficult. And also like all like the trauma that you go through in the meantime, like as you enter foster care, can also be defeating. And I think it's just a mental battle most of the time, that you just don't feel like doing anything anymore after going through the whole situation.
Yeah, I can imagine. And Danette Nordhoff, as you think about the young people that you've worked with through Samaritas. Can you put Robert's success in getting into college in some perspective for us? How hard is it for a young person in foster care to make that transition into a four-year college?
It's extremely difficult for any youth that are in foster care to transition to college. Like Robert indicated, the lack of support that is out there for foster youth, especially teens, is very difficult. And, you know, we look at this as trying to give them the support to not just reach their educational goal with high school, but also beyond, and setting them up with supports for their life. You know, I've seen a lot of youth that are college material, but they're just afraid to go on to college, and they don't have that extra family backing them to say, you can do it. You can move on. They might have one or two people in their corner, but they don't have a plethora like many other kids have.
And when I think of that transitioning out of foster care and making the leap to independent living, it's a precarious time for these youth who've been in foster care. How do you believe the Thomas House prepares them to live independently and make a successful leap?
So what I've seen is that Youth that are typically in residential facilities have a real difficult time transitioning to independent living, transitioning to be able to do many different things on their own. And so the Thomas House bridges that gap. So we try to get the youth that are in residential that don't need to be in residential.
Or, and when we say residential, let's get everybody on the same page. What does that mean?
Residential means youth being in a supervised setting where they typically have one-on-one or one-to-four ratio of somebody monitoring them, and being in a locked facility and or a very supervised setting where everything is monitored for them and they have little to no freedom to be a typical teenager.
And Robert, I know you spent some time in residential facility. How was that different from what you have at Thomas House?
So like going from not being in foster care where I was pretty much had all the freedoms that a teenager could ask for, to then going into residential and then having all that stripped from me. When I got to the Thomas House, it was actually like moving, and like I was so happy to finally like have that freedom back, because like there's like nothing for you to do in a residential setting. So when you get there and you're like, oh, I can finally be treated as like a normal teenager instead of like a little kid who needs to be monitored all the time, like I'm gonna do something bad when I'm not bad.
That is, I think, for people who aren't familiar with the foster care system, Danette Nordhoff, I think it's kind of, it might shock people to think, why are they being locked down? They didn't do anything wrong. They lost their families. Why so restrictive?
Unfortunately, we have a shortage of foster homes for teenagers in the state of Michigan. And so if we have a youth that's a teenager in foster care, we need a place for them to go. And if we don't have a foster home that's willing to take them, we have to place them in residential facilities so that they can receive the, a place to live, you know, some place to eat, some place to sleep, some place to provide the basic needs for them.
So Thomas House is different. How is it different from the residential facilities? What do you do differently?
So what we do differently is we have the youth come in. We let them, they got to pick their rooms when they got to the house. And we set up the house so it was like a family-friendly environment. And we sit down with them and we talk with them about what they want to achieve in the year that they're at the house. They can stay with us for up to a year. And we talk about the things that they want to achieve, and we work with them, myself, and our life skills coach, and all the other staff that are there, really push them to be better. We provide them just supervision when they need it. We provide a listening ear for when they need it, and just kind of somebody to joke around with, somebody to be in their corner, somebody to help them in whatever they might come across in life.
And those are the kind of tools that young people need to be able to make that move, let's say, to a dormitory on a campus?
Yes. So we provide a lot of life skills for them while they're at the Thomas House. So we look at, you know, teaching them how to properly clean if they don't know how to properly clean, because that's one of the things that they lack in some of the residential facilities, how to navigate social settings, how to handle stressful situations, how to communicate properly, how to balance education, employment, and social settings. It's a very delicate balance with some of the guys, but we're working on it. And Robert particularly is doing very well in being able to balance everything.
I'm wondering, from your perspective, what you think Michigan could do better to help teens in foster care, particularly to open up that pipeline to some kind of post-secondary education. Robert, what are your thoughts? What could Michigan do better?
I just don't think there's enough support for the youth when they are available or when they're ready to move out. There's nothing for them to go. We have like YVAC, which is like foster care that is voluntary after the age 18. But even with that, there's really nothing for them to like hold on to for like support or help or and so it's just universities and colleges are just scary because it's just more schooling, but it's harder. It's like deemed as harder and with no help. And so like with just being able to like provide more like support and like mentorship and getting over like the fear of it is like a lot of the issue going on with foster youth not going to post-secondary education.
Danette, what do you think? What could Michigan do better?
I honestly believe that we could do better by having more foster homes out there that are willing to take teenagers, but allowing there to be more facilities out there like the Thomas House. We have found it very difficult in our area in West Michigan to find places that we can house youth that we want to put in this independent living program because of local ordinances. And so it makes it extremely difficult to find residencies or neighborhoods that we can open up these houses at and provide the youth the service. Additionally, I think what Robert said as far as mentors, I think Michigan could put a little bit more of a push in the education system for these youth because it is very difficult for teenagers in foster care to actually graduate from high school and move on to college. And I think, unfortunately, we do not a great job in preparing youth that have been traumatized in preparing them for secondary education.
Robert, final question. What are you most looking forward to as you head off to Kuiper College in the fall?
I'm just excited that this is the new chapter of life. Really excited to move on and experience like real adulthood. That's just always been something I've always been looking forward to ever since I even got into high school. I've always been looking forward just to move on and be my own adult and do my own thing. So that's what I'm most looking forward to.
Well, we wish you luck as you head off to Kuiper College in the fall. And we want to thank you, Robert Filippo, who's been living at Thomas House, run by Samaritas, and its manager, Danette Nordhoff. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, as landfill space runs out, Kent County sees a huge opportunity to rethink its waste. And then in 10 minutes, Detroit, the birthplace of techno, is getting ready for its famed Movement Music Festival. We'll bring you some of the weekend's must-sees. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Rising populations produce more waste, which causes landfills to run out of space more quickly. Well, here's one solution. Rethink the old ways of managing solid waste. Kent County is doing just that. It's come up with a way to reuse or repurpose much of that solid waste rather than just flattening it and burying it in a landfill, turning the waste into an economic driver at the same time you reduce the amount of garbage that goes into landfills. To do that, Kent County wants to take land that has been earmarked for a future landfill expansion and instead use it for a sustainable business park. Darwin Boss is director of the Kent County Department of Public Works. So, Dar, what is a sustainable business park?
A sustainable business park is a resource park that provides infrastructure, both utilization and conversion technologies for municipal solid waste to process it and to turn it into either a fuel or energy or for reuse instead of a landfill.
So it's putting some money into what it takes to reuse and repurpose that solid waste in an intelligent way and not just stick it in the ground.
Correct.
Where did this idea come from?
Well, we have an integrated system here. We have waste to energy. We have a single stream processing facility for recycling, a landfill, and a transfer station. But we've continued to see the volume of material going to our landfill increase. And anecdotally, you know, we saw every day and took pictures of all this material that really could be used another way. And when we did a waste characterization study, it began to shed light on what is it that we're actually disposing of, and isn't there a better way to do it? So that was really the genesis of this thinking.
And in fact, that 2016 study by the West Michigan Sustainable Business Forum was kind of eye-popping in a sense of, figuring out how much valuable stuff is being buried as garbage. What, in a nutshell, what did you find in that study?
Well, the study showed us a few things. One is, so we have the Michigan deposit bottle law here, but over $1 million a year of deposit containers are thrown away in Kent County because of either lack of convenience or lack of knowledge. We just throw in a container, it goes away, we don't think about it, and you go, wow. So when you start looking at that and food waste and corrugated cardboard and construction materials, all those things compound, and before you know it, you're saying, okay, half of, to 75% of what goes to our South Kent landfill could readily be recycled or reused if we had different collection infrastructure or if we had different processing infrastructure.
And then that's what you can offer with this sustainable business park. I saw a story that was done in MLive, and I like the way you said you didn't want to look at another 200 acres of what you've seen of the traditional landfill. Let's do it differently. So it must kill you just thinking of all the total value of the material being thrown away that could be reused.
Well, it's multifaceted. So I've been in this business for 25 years, public sector, private sector, providing a lot of solutions for industry and our customers, and then more recently as a director here. So we've been in the business since the 60s. I mean, we were asked to enter into the municipal solid waste management business by the then Board of Supervisors of Kent County because there were so many open dumps and all these other challenges from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So we began to engineer and operate well-run facilities, including landfill. But we sited a landfill in the north part of Kent County, and we used 40 acres. Then we sited the South Kent landfill in Byron Township because we needed disposal capacity, and we used another 300 and some acres. And then in the 90s and up to today, we've been acquiring property, planning ahead, saying, what are we going to do when the South Kent landfill is full? Well, we're going to engineer an expansion and use up another 200 acres. And so my point to everyone is, and so when does this stop? Kent County is generating 2.1 million cubic yards of refuse every year. So it's not a one and done. It's not, well, it's just a big year. No. And then we continue to grow. West Michigan's growing. So what are we going to do in the future? And those are the questions we're asking.
And certainly you're watching that airspace fill up more rapidly than you expected at the South Kent County landfill. So, yeah, this is just – it's like a way to say let's just really change things. And I know in early March you issued a request for information for potential tenants and complementary technologies at the Sustainable Business Park. What are some of the most interesting ideas that came from those entries?
Sure, a number of them. One is traditional composting, which we understand is underrepresented here in Kent County. We need to be able to manage our yard waste and our food waste and other organics better. There's mining of our combustion ash from our waste-to-energy facility to remove the rest of the ferrous that we didn't capture the first time, along with all the non-ferrous metals and other things. There's conversion technologies to like gasification. And other suggestions and recommendations where we can either utilize the waste or convert it. So utilize it would be turning it into something else, another product. Conversion is to generate energy or a fuel from this material instead of placing it in the landfill where it's going to use up space, generate methane, and be problematic.
How involved has the community been in developing this idea of the Sustainable Business Park?
So we engaged, I think it was six different community groups, from the hauling industry to manufacturers, the environmental community, municipal leaders. Then we, from that, developed an advisory committee. Our Board of Public Works has been involved. And it seems like now is the right time to have this conversation because people are beginning to realize that landfills really never go away. Our South Kent landfill, very well constructed, well operated. If and when it closes in 2030, the state says that you have to manage that site for at least another 30 years. Well, that's 2060. And so you go, is that really what we want to do in the future?
What kind of timetable do you have in mind? When might this park be up and running?
So we're looking at reviewing all the responses to the request for information this spring. We're going to have a work session with our Board of Public Works probably in August, with a hope that by late fall we'll have a recommendation to offer to the full Board of Commissioners. And then from there, it's going to be a question of, are we ready to do this? Are we ready to implement this master plan and take the next steps? Because there'll be financing and other planning needs and things that have to come together. So I would hope by the end of the year we'll have clear direction on how to move forward if the community is ready for this.
Do you think Kent County will ever build another landfill?
No. I think we're ready to say, listen, there's always a portion of the waste stream that will need some type of land disposal. But it needs to be stabilized, it needs to be sanitized, and it needs to be processed before that happens. So our goal is by 2030 that 90% of what we're sending now to the landfill could be reutilized, which means there'll be a small amount that either we can continue to handle or there's other industry partners locally that can. But we're trying to exit and intend to exit the landfill business in 2030.
Darwin Boss, Director of the Kent County Department of Public Works. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It is time for a monthly review of music from Detroit artists. With us now, Paul Young, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine. This weekend, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, will be Movement Music Festival at Detroit's Hart Plaza. It has been a fixture for Memorial Day in Metro Detroit for many, many years. Paul, for someone who hasn't been, what is Movement Detroit all about?
Yeah, so for people who haven't heard, and I feel bad for you, you've been missing out for the last, I guess it is 18 years now, Movement started as it was formerly known as Detroit Electronic Music Festival, began in 2000, and it is one of the premier electronic music festivals in the world at this point, and Detroit being the birthplace of techno, but also a lot of influences nearby. You know, Chicago really transformed the way that house music is created, and then EDM has become a huge genre in itself over the last few years, so it really is kind of like Detroit is the mecca of electronic music and the birthplace of where it kind of all began. And so it's a celebration of that. But in recent years, it's really started to include other genres from jazz to funk to hip hop. And it's a really great melting pot of music. It's an awesome weekend to have a celebration of Detroit music.
And it draws people from what, around the world?
All over the world. And one of the biggest places where Detroit techno specifically is popular is, you know, in Germany, all over Europe, especially Berlin. There's a ton of electronic fans that come from all over the world. But certainly when our great artists from Detroit go over to Europe, they get the royal treatment. People are super into Detroit, super into techno. And so you see all kinds of cool characters over the weekend.
And I know there's a whole array of artists scheduled this year, as always, at Movement. But what percentage would you guess are local versus national or international?
You know, it's a pretty good split. And I think Movement does a wonderful job. PacSAO does a great job of balancing, you know, our talent here in Detroit versus the big draw that brings in some of the crowds. So certainly you have some of the names like Diplo and Maceo Plex and some of these really big names that people from all across the country are familiar with, but also we give our own a really big chance to shine. So we have our pioneers who we'll get into a little bit later, but we have a lot of also like celebrated local acts, people like Shigeto, Will Sessions, you know, DJ Dez, who was part of Slum Village, is going to be there. He's a staple. Kenny Larkin, Black Noise, Chuck Daniels, the list goes on and on, but there's a ton of great artists from Detroit this year, so I want to make sure to shout them out because that's really my favorite part of the weekend.
And now you want to put the spotlight on Detroit's techno pioneers, taking us on a little tour of some of these godfathers of techno in Detroit, starting with Kevin Saunderson. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Kevin Saunderson is one of the most prolific techno artists in the world. He's one of the Belleville Three. That's Kevin Saunderson, Juan Atkins, and Derek May, who are pretty much credited with inventing techno. And Kevin is just a total staple, like I said. If he goes over to Europe, you know, his treatment is a lot different here in Detroit. And I think that's one of the really interesting facets of Detroit's techno roots is that the interest really has been overseas for a long time. And finally, here on our own turf, we're starting to understand exactly how lucky we are. But yeah, Saunderson has really helped develop the sound. He was part of a group called Inner City, which is actually going to perform, which is really exciting. He's run his own label for like 30 years now. And yeah, he's a must-see Movement Weekend.
Let's listen to Kevin Saunderson in Art Department. This is Reveal. This is somebody that has been at this literally for decades.
Yeah, he's put in the work and has a huge following across the world. So like I said, if you go to the Detroit Historical Museum, they have all these handprints outside. I think it's called the Legends Plaza. And of course, there's Barry Sanders, there's Gordie Howe, there's Al Kaline, and then there's Kevin Saunderson, there's Juan Atkins, Derek May, Eddie Folks, and others who have, Carl Craig and others who have contributed to the techno movement. So these are really important people who have secured a place in Detroit music history forever.
And speaking of Eddie Folks, that's our next member of this kind of Hall of Fame of founding fathers. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so Eddie Flash and Folks, as they call him, a lot of people refer to him as the Belleville Fourth. He was certainly kind of ancillary to all these people, but inspired a lot of people in Detroit, in Chicago, of course, Berlin. And, you know, he worked with Kevin, but he also was a roommate of Derek May. So he founded his own labels, Detroit Wax and City Boy Records. And yeah, he's just hailed as one of the greatest.
So let's take a listen. Here's some of Eddie Folks from his Boiler Room Berlin DJ set. And as these artists are founding labels, that means they're opening the doors to new artists, right?
Absolutely. And that's been a big part of this. And just kind of going your own way and being independent, that's a huge part of Detroit techno culture, electronic culture. And as we're in kind of the internet age, we see that that's certainly the way music has gone now. It's easy to put your stuff online. But back then, you know, these were the pioneers of doing it yourself, exposing people to new music for the first time in clubs. And one of the really fascinating parts about Detroit techno is it was really about experiencing it live. So a lot of these guys do a lot of recordings, but they're famous for their live performances.
And now we move just a few years down the road to, I guess, the second generation of Detroit techno. Tell us about Stacy Pullen.
Yeah, Stacy Pullen is really part of, like you said, Cynthia, that second generation, and we consider Stacy, Carl Craig, and Jeff Mills to be kind of that new iteration. And a lot of people say that Stacy found his place between, you know, Jeff Mills, who had that minimalist style, and Carl Craig, who had that really futuristic look and still does. By the way, Carl Craig is playing this weekend as well. You really need to check him out. But yeah, so Stacy found that kind of that in-between spot, and he became a fixture overseas, especially in Amsterdam. He was kind of tugged out there by Derek May, so he's been all over the world, and he's a go-to for Movement Weekend as well.
Let's take a listen to some of his work. Here's Stacy Pullen. We'll be right back. Now, I just want to be clear for everybody who's listening going, I want more of this. Are all three, are they all playing this at Movement or not?
Yes, all three of these artists are playing at Movement, so I want to make sure to highlight them. And this is really for people who aren't familiar with, you know, maybe they've gotten into electronic on a national stage, but this sound is what makes Detroit special. It's what makes it the birthplace of techno. You know, all three of these artists have contributed so much to the genre. And if you ask anybody who's really, really into electronic, they'll know these names. So if you haven't been to Movement before and you're not sure where to start, this is where to start for sure.
And it's this Saturday, Sunday, Monday, this coming weekend at Hart Plaza. Come on and join Paul Young and plenty of other fans at Movement. And Paul Young, of course, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine. Thank you so much, Paul. Enjoy it.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Everybody's talking about the good old days.
After the break, five ideas to reverse the decline in Michigan education. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Education Trust Midwest continues its quest to prod our state's leader to do what's needed to improve our schools. It's out with a new plan containing five specific ideas to reverse the decline in Michigan education and put our state on track to become a top 10 education state. Amber Arellano is the group's executive director. That old saying, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, kind of jumps to mind here. You're offering recommendations based on actions that other states have taken that have improved their schools. What states are we talking about?
We're talking about places like Massachusetts that, if it was its own country today, would be top six in the world. Mm-hmm. It's so high performing. Last year, it set a new goal to be number one in the world, which is really pretty extraordinary. And it's so high performing, including for low-income students and black and brown students. You know, we're talking about low-income African-American and Latino students performing at similar levels of white suburban students in Michigan.
So, things that we can only dream of in this state at this point.
Yeah, we can do it, but we've got to really kind of change trajectory. States like Tennessee, where, you know, if you look back 15 and 20 years ago, lower performing than Michigan in practically every student outcome you can think about. Mm-hmm. Not a top state yet, mm-hmm. but certainly a very fast improving state and on track to be top 10 in the next 10 years.
Something we can shoot at. And I know we've gone over this. You've been extremely clear in past visits here about the trouble Michigan schools and students are in. You know, just a couple of ideas among the bottom five states for low-income students in eighth grade math, one of only 13 states whose early literacy achievement has dropped since 2003. I mean, the list goes on and on. Do you think there is any parent with a student in a Michigan public schools who can think, that's not happening in our school, that's not happening in our district?
I think it's easy to do that. And as a mom of a kindergartner mm-hmm. in a public school in a suburban district in Detroit, it's easy for me to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think as a parent, it's tempting to do that because you don't want to feel like you're putting your kid in a school, you know, that's somehow not the best public school that you ought to be giving them. At the same time, it's too risky to sort of stay in sort of the denial. It's easy for all of us. It's just human nature to say, you know, it's not that bad and just sort of like sweep it under the rug. And I think now is so important that we don't do that. This kind of moment that we're in history, we cannot stay in this sort of status quo mode that we've been in for a long time.
Where we're sliding the wrong way.
Where we're sliding the long way. And our new analysis that we mm-hmm. released today showed that white students have showed the largest decline in the nation since 2003 compared to white students in the rest of the country for fourth grade reading and math. The question is now is, what are we going to do about it? How do we come together together. Mm-hmm. We wanted to release this today in advance of the Mackinac Policy Conference, which will be next week at Mackinac Island, where there'll be hundreds of leaders coming around the state, including the gubernatorial candidates. And we want to send a really loud and clear message to them and to others that now is the time to step up. This is an important leadership moment in our state, and not just for our political candidates, but for everybody, right? For parents to step up, for leaders in different sectors to step up and say, like, we are going to make this a priority.
So we know that people can find the full report on your website at midwest.edtrust.org, but give us a kind of a PowerPoint of the five recommendations in your plan.
Yeah. So number one, you know, to be a top 10 education state, you have to have a top 10 teaching force, workforce. There are a lot of reasons why we haven't done that, but we got to get past them. We have a lot of baggage, and partly that this has become a political issue, right? This has become, education in many ways has become a partisan issue in Michigan, and we've got to get past it. It's not a partisan issue. It's a nonpartisan issue, and making sure that teachers are well-prepared, well-trained, well-supported, and that we have equitable support, right, and that we have equitable salaries. We have a huge problem with the gap in salaries for teachers between poor and rich districts. That's not fair to the teachers that are teaching in those places.
So, and you've seen it work in other states where when they've reduced that gap, you get good
results.
Absolutely,
right. We can't ask our teachers to be martyrs to teach in high-poverty mm-hmm. districts, right? Those kids actually mm-hmm. need the best teachers to help them catch up with their peers. Number two, we need both adequate and equitable resources, right? And so we're not a bad state for pupil spending. In fact, we're a little lower pupil spending than this fast-improving Tennessee, but we do have a huge gap in terms of equity between rich and poor districts, and we've got to address that. Number three, I think that it's easy to say it's all about the money, if we only had more resources. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, that's not true either. You know, you hear Democrats say that, and you hear Republicans say, well, but we're actually not a low-spending state. We ought to be doing more with the existing resources that we have. And they're both right.
They're both right.
We're both right, right? And so, again, this is why it's not a partisan issue. We've got to be doing both of those things together in order to become both more effective and more equitably resourced. Number four, there's going to be a lot of talk next week and then this year, I think, in the election about spending more money. Mm-hmm. And if we just put more money in, it'll all be fine. And there's just no evidence. The research does not show that, right? We know that poor kids in particular need more resources and supports. But we also know that money alone is not the predictor, right, the solo predictor of student achievement and student outcomes. So we've got to have more accountability, right, for everybody. Because, again, we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. And that means teachers and principals. It means charter school operators. It means intermediate school districts. It means policymakers. It means the governor. I mean, everybody has got to take more responsibility. And we need the kind of improvement and accountability systems put into place so that we can really hold those actors more accountable. And then lastly, we need parents to step up, you know, making sure that we're reading every day to our kids, especially, you know, as they're learning how to read in these early years. It also means getting more active. We're inviting people to go to MichiganAchieves.org and sign up and get involved and help us send a message to these gubernatorial candidates this year to make this a top priority. It also means that the state needs to be more honest with parents about how we're really doing. You know, we can't have the state sending school report cards home to parents and saying everything's fine, your school is actually doing really well, and then expect parents to not know better, right? I mean, if you're not being given honest information about how schools are really doing here, it is easy to get complacent.
Are we saying that the state is misleading people in the information it's giving them about their schools?
Yeah, I think that information has either been difficult to access or tweaked to look better than it has traditionally. And I think we got to give the Michigan Department of Education credit here because they've actually been looking to make a shift on that this year. And we've got to make sure that they keep that on track and release this really important, more honest information to parents.
Amber, I know every few months you come in, we sit down, we talk about the test scores that are sliding across the board and the funding inequities between the affluent and the high poverty districts, how Michigan students are being lapped by students in other states. And it seems that each time we kind of have the same conversation, we spell out the problems, offer solutions, rinse, lather, repeat. Are you going to be back here in 3 or 4 months and we'll have the same conversation again?
I hope not. We'll be in the thick of a gubernatorial election, and I hope that with so many voices and more organizations and leaders really calling on gubernatorial candidates to say, enough is enough. We have a serious leadership problem in our state, and it starts from the top down. Whoever the new governor is, and as a nonpartisan organization, we don't have opinion mm-hmm. about that. Whoever that is, we've got to make sure that they're really, really leading, owning the problem, and following a nonpartisan research-based path on it. We can't allow public education to be kicked around like a partisan football anymore.
You will find the full report by going to the website midwest.edtrust.org. It's the first thing you see when you go on that website, and lots of information to be gleaned from that. Amber Arellano, Executive Director of the Education Trust Midwest. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
The counties in Southeast Michigan cannot agree on a regional transportation plan. Regional unity is an uphill struggle. So a new report done for Michigan Future seems particularly timely. The title, Regional Collaboration Matters, How Metro Minneapolis Has Forged One of the Wealthiest and Most Livable Metropolitan Areas in the United States. Journalist Rick Haglund wrote the report, and he's with us now. In broad terms, Rick, why is the Twin Cities area in Minnesota so successful?
Well, they do a lot of things right. They have, as you mentioned, they have some really good regional cooperation. They have a diverse economy. They have focused on education. They have also focused on transit, which a lot of millennials really need and want in terms of where they want to live. And they've also done a really good job of amenities, parks, livability, placemaking type features, and are a very welcoming metropolitan area to many different kinds of people.
And one of the interesting engines that has helped this region is the Metropolitan Council. Tell us about the Met Council, how it's structured, and how is it unique?
Well, yes, as you said, it is a unique organization. It is somewhat similar to our Southeast Michigan Council of Governments. What happened is back in the 1960s, the federal government required metropolitan areas to set up these regional planning agencies in order to qualify for federal highway funds. Minneapolis took it a step further. They had some interesting problems there. They had a privately financed bus line that was going out of business. They had lots of wastewater treatment problems. So they decided to set up their planning agency to have actual powers to run some of these things, to run the transit system, to run the wastewater treatment plants. They don't do drinking water, but they do the wastewater treatment. They administer the federal housing vouchers, as well as doing the traditional planning operations. And one of the reasons that it got set up that way is, as I say in the report, there's a former governor at the time who looked at it and said, well, you know, the region has lots of problems that cross boundaries that individual units can't solve themselves, and it would be better to set up a regional system to address these things. So it was unusual in that they gave it actual powers to run regional services and functions, which almost no one else did.
Not just advisory, not just turning out reports.
No, it actually has powers to, like I said, run the transit system, run the wastewater treatment. They have even some veto powers over development that they think may not be in the best interest of the region in terms of maybe gobbling up land that should be preserved for parks or what have you.
So decisions are made on more than just a county-wide or a very hyper-local level.
That's correct. There's been a lot of controversy about it. It was set up, all of the members, there's a 17-member board, they're all appointed by the governor. And there's been a lot of complaints over the years that this makes it unaccountable to local officials. But it was set up that way basically to try to avoid, you know, parochial battles between local officials.
You mean something like we're seeing in Southeast Michigan, for example, over our transportation?
Yes, something like that. Yes.
Yeah. How does the state legislature oversee the ordinances or laws that the Met Council puts forth?
Well, they basically established the powers to allow them to run the transit system and do those other things. So the Met Council just basically carries out the functions that the powers that the state legislature gave them.
How many counties are we talking about in Metro Minneapolis?
It's a 6-county region.
All right, so it's pretty comparable to what we have for the Southeast Michigan area. So let's talk about that regional transportation challenge that we're wrestling with here. I know in Minneapolis, the fight to get a light rail was, 40 years in the making?
Yeah, it started back in the 70s when the legislature allowed the local units of government to assess a transit tax. And, the region decided that they wanted light rail in the mix of transit options, so they began working towards that direction. There had been fights back and forth in the legislature. One year's money would be appropriated, the next year it wouldn't be appropriated. It sort of depended on, the political control of the legislature. So it was, there was a lot of funding debates in the legislature. There were lawsuits, lots and lots of things, but they basically persevered until they got several rail lines built.
You write about schools, and we have often talked. I know Bridge has done deep dives into how well Minnesota schools do. We've talked about that a lot on Stateside. Minnesota schools are some of the best in the country, but spending on education in Minnesota is not too high, huh?
No, they're actually sort of in the, a little bit above average. The one area where they're a little higher is that schools get about 65% of their funding from the state, which is one of the highest in the country. So their funding isn't, doesn't particularly stand out. What seems to be the case is it's just sort of, success sort of begets success. The state really focused on improving education back in the 1950s and reforming the tax structure so that more of the funding came from the state and was more even across school districts. And over time, one of the things that happened was more and more of the citizenry became better educated. And, as a result, their children became better educated. So it was just kind of a positive snowball effect.
When I look at what you put out here, the fact that Metro Minneapolis is 12th in per capita income among the 53 regions with a population of 1 million or more, best in the Great Lakes, Metro Detroit is 30th, and Metro Grand Rapids is 38th. So based on what you've seen in this deep dive you've done into Metro Minneapolis, what are the main lessons that we in Michigan can learn from what they're doing in Metro Minneapolis?
Well, I think regional government is part of it. It's a very hard thing to accomplish, and there's lots of debates in Minnesota right now about whether they should continue with the Met Council the way it is. But it's paid dividends for them. It's provided good transit. It's provided affordable wastewater treatment services. It's generally seen as more efficient than if the local units did all this stuff by themselves. Education has been a very big factor. I talked to one economist who said basically it's the biggest thing that's led to a prosperous Minneapolis region. They're welcoming, and one of the things I guess we haven't talked about yet is their business leadership has been very crucial.
Let's talk about that. So what are they doing right as far as their business leadership?
Well, there's an organization that was formed called the Itasca Project, which has gotten some publicity in recent years. There was a nice story about them in the New York Times a while back. They're a unique organization in that they are CEOs that are working on entrenched problems that go beyond traditional business concerns in terms of things like taxes and business regulation, that sort of thing. One of the things that I heard again and again, both from business leaders and others as I did this report, the big challenge that they are working on and they feel is very important is closing racial and economic disparities in the region. They do it partially from a moral standpoint. It's the right thing to do. But also it's because the region is becoming more and more diverse. And they realize that, the white working age population is expected to decline over the next 20 years or so. The real growth in available workers is going to be in the minority population. And there's just a strong sense that they have to bring people up in terms of educational attainment, and that the region has to work for everybody to be successful.
There's plenty of food for thought, and you can go to MichiganFuture.org to download Rick Haglund's new Metro Minneapolis case study titled Regional Collaboration Matters. Rick Haglund, it's always great talking with you. Thanks so much.
You too, Cindy. Thanks.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Sam Corey, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.